Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another Daily Friend episode. I am your host for today, Nicholas Lorimer. Today, joined by Mr. Ofense Donald Davey. Ofense, how are you doing this fine Friday? It is, of course, Halloween. Are you ready to do something spooky this evening?
I'm well, thank you. And no, none of that. Spooky, maybe just reading a book all night.
That's the true horrors, the ongoing ennui of modern life. No, but let me not get too up my own backside here. And I'm also joined today by Anlu Kieva. Anlu, how are you doing?
It feels so odd to be on the show the very last day of a month or the very first day. So very happy to join on the 31st.
Indeed. Very good to have you guys. It is a warm, sticky day in Cape Town. So apologies if I look like I'm perspiring even more than usual. Let's get into the news of today. First thing we're going to talk about is what I'm probably going to call this episode, which is a really irritating title, but I like it so much I'm probably going to do it anyway. Is it a GNU dawn for the GNU? And this is after reporting that the Government of National Unity's Clearing House Mechanism, which is supposed to be the sort of body that regulates disputes within the GNU, has finally, after more than a year, agreed on some terms of reference that the committee will work under. The working group has formulated the following terms of reference. The structure will operate as a recommending body, not a decision-making one. So basically, no one can be forced to do anything in the GNU. The clearinghouse will meet monthly. It's kind of funny that, you know, how often it meets hadn't even been agreed upon up till now. And all unreserved, this is probably the most interesting one, all unresolved issues between the various parties in the Government of National Unity will be referred to the Political Leaders Forum, not President Cyril Ramaphosa, and that when parties don't agree on an issue, they must agree to disagree when consensus fails. This was announced by the spokesperson for Deputy President Paul Mashatile, who chairs the clearinghouse mechanism. As was pointed out, I think in a talk given to us by Professor William Gumede, when the original sort of idea for these clearinghouse mechanisms was proposed, the idea is that you're supposed to have an outside moderator chairing these. So by putting the whole thing is kind of, in a sense, being poisoned from the start by having the deputy president, who is obviously an interested party in favor of the ANC, chairing this thing. Anyway, so these terms have been announced by the deputy president's spokesperson. This is more than a year after the thing came into being. I think it had like a couple meetings and then nothing really came of it because everyone just fought with each other. There was a working group. It was chaired by the Deputy Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development, Andries Nel.
That is hilarious. I'm pretty sure Nicholas Lorimer will join us momentarily again. In the meantime, if you would give me a minute, I can quickly open the story up on my side. Here we go.
Eventual stuff.
Oh, he's back. Wonderful. I was just about to start hosting and talking about our...
Oh, no, sorry. Where did you lose me? Where did you lose me?
No, just the last two sentences. You were just talking about somebody's quote.
Yeah. So, lastly, they've agreed that provincial and local government matters are not going to be part of this whole thing. So I don't know. You know, one might be tempted to say, oh, wow, this GNU has actually, you know, kind of reached a status quo and it's moving towards working. And, you know, maybe this is the beginning of a new chapter for the GNU. But I don't know. Ofense, my sense here is that this is just a recognition of reality. This is just going to be a talk shop where people argue with each other a little bit. But it doesn't have any, as is clear from the terms of reference, there's no ability to actually decide anything, and everyone's just going to agree to do what they're already doing. So I think this is kind of a recognition of reality. What's your take?
So my take on it, I have two takes on it. One that I thought of earlier is that this is just a checkbox ticking activity. They agreed to do this back last year. Like you said, it took over 12 months to finally do this. And it's just to say, okay, the statement of intent says we need to build this mechanism. It took us so long to do it, but we finally did it. And moving forward, we will use it, especially considering that it's meant for recommendations and not decision making. So that already says a lot about what it's going to be used for, but we will use it. And when it's being used, it'll be used by the ANC as an excuse to not politicize the GNU as it already has been, especially between the tension, especially because of the tension between the ANC and the DA. And what I mean by that is that the budget next year, there could be more conflict that comes up. The conflict that came up this year, there was no mechanism to handle the dispute. It was all political, it was in the media, it was loud, it was noisy, it was a mess, and it was just embarrassing for our government. So now this time, whenever another conflict like that, another dispute like that comes up again, the ANC is going to be like, there's this mechanism that you need to go through these channels and suggest your recommendations. That'll gladly happen, sure, but then that doesn't stop the ANC from abusing its power, its 40%, its majority within the GNU to just do whatever it wants to do as it already has been before this mechanism was built up. So really it's just a checkbox ticking activity and more of the same is still going to come out with the GNU. My second take on it, which I just thought of now when you mentioned what Professor William Gumede said, that you really need an external mediator for this kind of thing. It reminded me of the, what's it called even? I even forgot what it's called because we don't talk about it anymore. The National Dialogue. Reminds me of the National Dialogue and how people have been...
I keep forgetting that's still a thing.
I forget that's a thing. I literally forgot what it was called. How people have been withdrawn from it because they feel as if the ANC has hijacked it. Well, this is exactly what's happening here. If the chair of this new thing is going to be chaired by the deputy president, by the decision makers. So if we're going to get a bunch of parties within the GNU in this room to make recommendations, and then the decision maker does not like these recommendations, the decision maker is going to make the decisions they want to make. So it's the same of what we've been getting the past 12 months, and the next 12 months, it'll just be a continuation. There won't be any tangible change out of this.
So picking up from that, Anlu, what does the next year's budget discussion look like? Are we going to see another big fight like we saw this time?
Well, I certainly hope not. It would be a mess. I think I just want to quickly comment on this clearinghouse situation, and then I'll turn to the budget. But I had a joke, which is how many civil servants does it take to change a globe? It takes multiple of them, and it takes many working groups, and essentially a year and a half for them to decide that they're not changing a globe. They are actually trying to set up a terms of reference. So complete mess, and very disappointing to know that it takes the civil service months and multiple meetings to come up with a flow diagram, essentially. And the conclusion is that they'll meet once a month. How on earth is that even a solution to discussing coalition agreements? And something that I noticed or thought of when I thought about this a little bit is that we have to keep in mind, this now means that whenever a dispute does come up, they are going to meet once every 4 weeks. So only in those 4 weeks it will be discussed. It's going to take them at least three of these sessions, so let's say 3 months, to realize that they are disagreeing about something. Now, after three months, it needs to go to the political leaders forum, and it will take them another couple of months to come to some agreement to disagree about it. We need the GNU in government. We can't afford these delays. We need them to actually step up and ramp up this entire decision-making process that we have going. As for the budget, the midterm budget speech, which is on the 12th of November, is very, very important. We know that it sets a good baseline for the February budget that will be released. I'm pretty sure that there will be some, Well, I'm not reading tea leaves. I never try read tea leaves. But we do need some adjustments. I don't think it's going to be necessarily on VAT again. I think they've kind of burned their fingers there. But I certainly think we should keep an eye on maybe some fuel levy adjustments. Yeah, so we'll keep an eye on that as it comes in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, I suspect that, you know, in a sense, the reality is that all this is just accepting that this is all a one big nasty political fight, that the GNU is a very much an alliance of convenience. It is not anything like a genuine government in the sense that it has some kind of common action plan. It's just sort of an acceptance of the political reality that the ANC has to share power. And the result is we're going to continue to see this sort of siloed thing where each ministry does what it wants to do as far as it can. And the parties fight it out as though they were not in government together, particularly the ANC and DA. When you mentioned the National Dialogue, I was like, what's the next date in the National Dialogue? So I went to just quickly do a search online while you were doing that, while you were talking, Unlu. And I see that we had the first convention, which we talked about back in August. And next is supposed to be thousands of local conventions facilitated with toolkits and trauma-aware practices in person and online. Date to be confirmed. So apparently no one knows when the next stage of the National Dialogue is.
How perfect is this?
maybe they need a working group to discuss whether when the next date.
Exactly. That's how I see this is going to happen. Like, we're going to have meetings about having meetings about having meetings. It's totally inefficient. And in the meantime, they are paid millions of rands to come up with flow diagrams.
I want to touch on the point you made as well, that they meet up only once a month. I can already imagine that. I can already picture it. It's the perfect excuse the ANC would use whenever the DA, obviously not any of the other parties, would have an issue that would come up. And then the Secretary General of the ANC would be like, but we have a meeting on this date, and this is where you can bring up this issue. But then if the issue is immediate, then, you know, you're kind of stuck, and they can't express their grievances because now there's this protocol that has to be followed, which probably won't be followed.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what's going to happen. And then the DA will just ignore that, and they'll put out a media statement. There'll be a whole fight that will happen in the space of a week, right? Like, it'll be on in the media and on social media, and it'll just be this big, like, everyone will be divisions, and there'll be people in the ANC saying we must end the GNU, and the John Steenhuisen will make some noise about walking out. And then the issue will be put on the agenda for the next meeting, which when it eventually happens, it'll be completely moot because everyone will have moved on. I mean, it's actually kind of silly. Anyway, interesting stuff. But I think not a GNU dawn at all. I think it's the bottom line from all this. Anyway, let's move on to a topic which we all have slightly different feelings on, but still worth talking about. There's currently a court case unfolding between the city of Johannesburg and a group of street traders, informal traders, who are fighting over permitting and operations to remove them from trading in the inner city. The city approved an informal trading policy in 2022, which was supposed to be this blueprint for regulating street trade. And the idea was that the objectives stated in the policy was that this would enhance order, safety, and economic growth. They were going to introduce a digital permit system, and there would be a transparent allocation of trading stalls. But policy was not implemented until October of 2025. The street traders themselves had ran afoul of the Metro cops who showed up in the city recently and, you know, took people's goods and fined them and sort of prevented them from trading. Many of the informal traders say basically describe a system that's pretty chaotic, that none of their licenses have been renewed since 2012, and that the last one expired in 2016, and they've been trying to sort of get clarity. They're now taking the city to court, saying that it's infringing on their constitutional right to trade. One of the informal traders group's leaders said, "Let's hold on and pray that the court upholds the rules of the country. The ANC thinks they can claw back power by removing foreign nationals from the streets. They are coming with a xenophobic strategy." One of the traders said that he's been trading since 2002 and that he makes 450 to 500 rand a week to support his children. "Since trading has been interrupted, I will not be able to provide for my children. I cannot even provide them lunch money. If the prohibition on trade continues, my children and I will end up homeless." Another informal trader earns 3,000 rand a month, said, "My three children will stay with my mother back home and in Mpumalanga, are entirely dependent on me. Being unable to work will make them suffer, and they will starve and not be able to go to school." Another one who sells belts, bags, and socks near the Nuer taxi rank said, "I have no money to pay rent as of the current month, and my four school-going children will suffer. The children and myself will have nothing to eat, and they will be affected in school." So my sympathies are often, generally speaking, I think, with informal traders. I tend to not like over-licensing and over-regulation as a general rule. And it does irritate me that we have this sort of national conversation all the time. Oh, we want small business. We want, we want township economy to flourish. We want people to be able to engage in entrepreneurship. But the moment anyone actually engages in entrepreneurship, we say, oh, well, no, not like that. And then immediately you get regulations and as we know, Metro Cops and SAPs often do not have the gentlest hand when enforcing the law. And so you see basically small business people like this who are working hard to make a living, getting harassed and chased around and just driven up the wall with bureaucracy. Ofensa, you mostly agree from our pre-show discussion, but you also do take a slightly different emphasis here, which is that this does need to be regulated. Do you want to just talk a little bit about that?
Yes, yeah, for sure. So my point on where I slightly disagree, even though it's not too much of a disagreement, which is that I believe the rule of law should still be enforced. So I'm based in Pretoria here in Tshwane, and there's a market here in Marabastad, but not only Marabastad, but also the inner city of Pretoria. There are informal traders, and it creates a bit messy. It's a bit messy all over the place, but also sometimes on the side of the road where cars are meant to be going, so on and so on. So I believe that the government's initiative to try to at least professionalize the informal trading sector should be welcomed, and it should be welcomed, but the law should also be good. So if I'm growing mangoes in my backyard, I want it to be as easy as possible for me to try and go out and sell them. And the government should not make that more difficult for me. But I should also take a slight responsibility when I do sell my mangoes and not interfere with any other bylaws or interfere with any other people's lives. I shouldn't go in the middle of the road in front of cars, try to sell them. Not saying that the informal traders are doing exactly that. It's a facetious example. But there are laws, and they should be enforced, and they should be improved as well. We can fix the issue of informal trading, and it can be professionalized. It can benefit both traders and also normal pedestrians who just want a pathway to walk on without having a stall in front of them, in front of their office, and so on and so on. So it's just our lawmakers, especially in the local level, I reckon they should be a bit more creative and a bit more empathetic as well. But the informal traders as well should be working with government and trying to find a solution and meet each other halfway.
Yeah, no, I think I do agree with all that. We currently have this situation where we basically have overly restrictive laws that are also badly enforced. I think the sort of synthesis here is that, you know, if you have a few clear, simple, well-enforced rules that prevent, you know, street traders basically making a mess or blocking sidewalks or just causing sort of, you know, traffic and other types of congestion issues. And currently what we have is overly complex systems badly enforced. So we kind of, in a sense, are getting, you know, we're not really even getting the law and order that we're supposed to be getting from the permitting system. And at the same time, we're preventing people from being able to do business. You know, it would be bad enough if we only had one or the other. Like, either we had orderly streets or we allowed people to just get on with their livelihood. We currently have neither.
Exactly.
So the status quo, yeah, clearly needs some change.
Exactly. Regulation still serves a purpose, but over-regulation is over. It's not good. So there needs to be a balance.
Right. Anlu, your take on all this?
I think it's important. We often look at the law as something that is against the people. But I think the reason we have rules and regulations is it's in service of the people. And I think that we tend to think these rules and municipal bylaws are supposed to restrict informal traders, whereas my view of it is that it should be in service of these traders to help them grow their businesses and help them eventually to formalize these businesses. Now, something that particularly touched me when I first heard it was Gigi Alcock's explanation that informal traders are not people who have these small businesses just because they have no other option. And that if they were offered another opportunity, they would be more willing to work for somebody else. And that's not the correct view. These people, in some cases, yes, they are doing what they are doing because there's no other option. But many of these people embody that entrepreneurial spirit. They set goals. They buy themselves new tables. They want to buy new signs. So I think the reason that we have municipal laws and national regulation is to enable these people to have their stalls and to eventually be able to buy a table and to buy a sign and eventually to formalize their businesses. And I think the vibrant informal economy, which we already have, but which we could potentially have, could expand much faster if we slashed red tape and we provided better infrastructure like storage facilities for these people to lock their stuff up. For instance, I'm not saying that the government should provide these, but I mean, there's many instances where infrastructure in a community is of such a horrible state that these things are not even. I mean, if you take, for example, policing, storage facilities, if there's high crime rates, which in many of these streets where these informal traders operate, there are higher crime rates, then storage facilities are not even safe for them to store their stuff in. So improved policing. And then, I mean, just less municipal dysfunction would be a great win for even these traders. And then if I think of what is standing in the way of these informal traders to get to a point where you mentioned this person who they did the interview with mentioned that he makes around 500 rand a week. So let's say 2000 rand a month for him to get to a point where he makes enough money to build a bigger business and to expand his business. There's two things that come to mind immediately that is standing in the way of this and is keeping his business and the informal sector unusually small. And the first is just the excessive regulation that we have. Much of the regulation that we have for the informal sector is better suited for a developed nation. And we need to keep in mind that we have very low growth rates. We want to grow our economy. And again, municipal bylaws is a particular situation where they are restricting these things. And then secondly is just our poor infrastructure. It's a major obstacle. Informal streets, informal traders who stand in the street, they need street lights, they need running water. It would be much better if they actually have environments in which they can operate and invite more people to actually buy from them. Maybe it's useful for us to not only think of what's wrong and what's standing in their way, but also to think of the solutions. And it's a difficult one. Ufense mentioned it. We need a bit of creative thinking. We need thinking out of the box to help the informal sector grow. And I think the first step is to just simplify the relevant regulations and to make sure that what remains is as efficiently implemented as possible, whether it's forms or fees or whatever that is. So I agree with you, Nicholas. Limited rules, but very well enforced, so that they can build that base for the informal sector and trader to build their own business.
Just before I come to you for final thoughts, Ufense, there's just something perverse about how we do things in South Africa, where we have all these things that make it difficult for the economy to grow and for people to get jobs. And then when people kind of go and try and do their own thing outside of normal employment and like make their own business or something, we put another roadblock in the way. It's almost like the rules of our society are designed like if you were a malevolent overlord trying to keep everyone poor in South Africa, you'd probably come up with a lot of rules that were sort of similar to what we have in South Africa. And I think this is an ongoing sort of nightmare for us. Ufense, final thoughts.
Yeah, we also shouldn't think of enforcing the rule of law as a zero-sum game. So the rights of someone shouldn't infringe the rights of someone else. These regulations on informal traders, yes, they should make it as easy as possible for them to trade, but we also need to look out for those who are not informal traders but are impacted by informal traders. We need to strike a balance somewhere, somehow. We need to get more creative, but we shouldn't, at the moment, it looks like a zero-sum game. It's difficult for these informal traders to trade. At the same time, there are complaints by pedestrians and cars on the roads and just in terms of safety as well. Like, but these informal traders are also not in the safest of places. So like Andrew mentioned about building infrastructure, we can make it a pro-sum game. We can make it easier for those that trade and those that don't trade. It's just that at the moment, that's not where we are. The regulations are hurting both sides of the aisle.
All right, let us move on to our last one. This is about the schemes to begin implementing National Health Insurance, NHI. Just a reminder for those who are not unaware, NHI is basically this plan that instead of the idea is that when it's fully realized, no one in the country will have private medical insurance, or at least no private medical insurance that would otherwise be covered by the state. The state will collect money and then pay hospitals to provide that cover. So it'll be sort of the idea is to basically sort of spread medical insurance to the whole country. Of course, there are many problems with this. Imagine having a giant state-owned enterprise whose sole purpose is to collect and spend money. The corruption opportunities are phenomenal. Never mind that private health insurance in South Africa actually works pretty well, and simply allowing more people to have access to that is probably a much better solution. And also that to actually make the system work, it's very expensive. Well, due to the cost stuff and the political headwinds and all of that, and various court judgments against NHI, there's, sort of been the slowing down of its implementation, even though it is the law of the land by government. Government is now sort of talking about like a 15-year period to actually implement NHI, which, as far as I'm concerned, is almost as good as not really realistic, because, the country will be utterly different in 15 years. Who knows? In fact, the current government almost certainly won't be in power in 15 years. And yet, the sort of chief champion of the NHI, the one of the top bureaucrats in the health department, Dr. Nicholas Crisp, has put forward a proposal to Parliament that as early as April next year, they will begin scrapping tax credits in order to start paying for NHI. So currently, you know, if you pay medical aid, you get money back from the government in tax credits. The Board of Healthcare Funders has written to Treasury, the Treasury's Director General, asking for urgent clarity on whether this is actually going to happen. This is after the proposal by Dr. Crisp, who said that the initial target is to scrap tax credits for people earning over 750,000 rand a year, but the sort of idea is that this will slowly be expanded until everyone who pays private medical aid is no longer getting tax credits. The Board of Healthcare Funders has said that this presentation was puzzling, as it is odds with recent affidavits he filed in legal proceedings over the NHI Act, which he said there was no intention of reducing the ability of lower income medical scheme beneficiaries to retain membership before NHI is fully in operation. Removing tax credits could make medical scheme membership unaffordable for between 430,000 to 690,000 medical aid scheme members, forcing many to downgrade their cover, remove dependents, or exit the system entirely. So, Anlu, there's sort of two aspects to this, right? On one hand, you know, the NHI stuff here saying, no, don't worry, we're just gonna start with the rich people. I mean, firstly, we're already taxing the rich people an awful lot. It's yet another tax on them, going to encourage them to move their money away or to move overseas. And secondly, you know, it's clearly the thin end of the wedge, and then eventually the poor will also lose their tax credits. And so you will essentially be consigning 500,000 people to public hospitals. And do we really believe any of that, the money saved by government, I think it's 11 billion rand or so, 30 billion rand, is actually really going to go to helping patients rather than caters?
No, I don't believe that. So I think just for the past 30 years, South Africa has, in every aspect, or rather in more aspects than not, been chasing down the wrong policy path. You mentioned earlier how it's almost, if you were this big overlord, then you would have created all these rules and regulations. And I think that's exactly it. Government is looking for whatever possible avenue and way there is for them to make the South African population as reliant on them as possible. I mean, why not take away that excellent, we have a wonderful private healthcare system. Why not take away the people who can in fact afford it, take away theirs, and just give everybody nothing, horrible healthcare? I mean, if you just consider that since 1994, the public healthcare sector has increased in nominal terms something like 1,550% in spending. And if you actually look at the outcomes that we've seen, on every measure, it has worsened. There is, I mean, you mentioned before in our pre-show discussion, the story that Jeff Wicks explained in the Tembisa case. And it honestly just touched my heart, because it is horrible how I almost want to just tell these corrupt officials, I hope you enjoy your Lambo while ordinary South Africans are starving in institutions and hospitals that were supposed to heal their illnesses. I genuinely do not understand how these people can live with themselves. Corruption in the public healthcare is so widespread, and it's costing the system billions of rands. And now they want to take away the parts that is working and just open the door for more corruption throughout the entire system. And I mean, low-cost options, it's not that I liked Ofense's explanation previously of the zero-sum game. This is not the type of situation where if some people have private medical care, that the other people must have horrible care, or everybody must have horrible care. There are low-cost options available, and these were supposed to become operative in, I think, 2016 already. But the ANC has, once again, as an example, just blocked the introduction of these low-cost schemes, and has actually, they've admitted to see these as stumbling blocks to the path of NHI. And it's one of those instances where the government's just, whatever avenue they can take to get people to be as reliant on them and to not be self-sufficient, they've just decided to not give these low scheme options. And some of these schemes, if I'm not mistaken, some estimates say that it's 130 rand a month, which if I tell people that, and when I found it out myself, it seems like, no, I must be joking. I must be joking. Surely not. But there are plans and schemes available for these people. So this is one of those situations where for long people has spoken about the uncertainty that will come with NHI, the corruption that will come with NHI. And here we already see people asking questions and saying, listen, that 36 billion rand, which I think is the number that goes to tax credits, medical tax credits, kind of what are you going to do with it? Where is it going? And I would encourage whoever is interested to go read and Dr. Anthea Jeffries' healthcare vouchers proposals, where she has used those medical tax credits and actually put them into funding healthcare vouchers and the benefits that those would offer. So yeah, definitely not a good situation, Nicholas.
So I'm going to come to you for some final thoughts, Fencer, because we are going a bit long. So I think we'll wrap it up now. But just sort of on, you know, what the private sector is able to accomplish when it's sort of allowed space to actually provide things to the poor. Take, for example, you know, sort of legal advice services. I remember those adverts, be nice, I have legal advice, which always used to be on TV for things like clientele legal and stuff. And, you know, you can get like legal advice and coverage for 330 rand a month. Now, you know, is it always the best or good stuff? Well, you know, I don't know for myself, but the point being that, you know, you can, the private sector is actually really good at making things affordable for people. Sort of low-cost services are pretty good. And when you compare the potential for, okay, maybe 130 Rand medical aid scheme won't be amazing coverage. It'll only cover you for a very limited number of things, or you'll get sort of fairly small improvements in treatment. It's better than public hospitals, which are a nightmare. And many people who should not have died will die in those because of how badly run they are. Offenser, your thoughts?
Don't talk to me. Talk to my lawyer. I loved those ads.
Yeah, that's another one.
But yeah, to start off, first of all, you can't tax people to prosperity. We need to build infrastructure. We need to build institutions, and we need to create. So that's my first point. The second point is that socialism or socialists have this idea that the rich are not doing enough, when in reality they're contributing the most. They are already paying the most taxes because they are earning the most. So adding an extra burden to them because there's this idea that they're not doing enough is going to hurt them, and it's also going to hurt everyone else who their taxes go to. So what this is going to do, the increase in premiums, is that eventually, because they're starting off with the very rich, and then it'll boil down to middle class, and then eventually everyone's going to have to pay higher taxes. What this will do, it'll make all private medical schemes already rely on a small group of the population. If you make it more difficult for more people, less people will pay for it. Where these people will go, they'll either go to the missing middle, where they can't afford private healthcare, but they don't want to go to a public clinic or hospital, so they just don't get medical treatment. Or he'll also go to the public healthcare system that's already burdened with that's already burdened, and hence why there needs to be a solution in our healthcare system. If you get more people into that, then for an initiative that's meant to fund a program in 15 years, what's going to happen now in the future? It's going to be a disaster in the public healthcare system. We're going to add more strain into it, but we're also going to add more strain to the private healthcare system, who will be earning less money because less people will be able to afford it, and will start canceling their medical aid. It's a vicious cycle. It's hurting people. It's hurting everyone, both those that can and can't afford. And this is if the funds that are collected are even used for what they're supposed to be used for.
Right.
We saw with Tumbisa, right, all the examples you made. So I'm not even considering the corruption, the potential corruption aspect of this. From now to 15 years, even if there is no corruption, it's still detrimental. So now if you consider corruption as well, it's a ticking time bomb, and I don't even want to imagine what it's going to look like.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, I like, if we had a very efficient value for money state that spent everything correctly, like, yes, okay, I could see the argument for NHI, but we don't have that state. You know, I don't think I'd agree with NHI in that circumstance either, but at least it would be reasonable. In the current thing, you know, this is just going to be like throwing water into the sand of the Sahara, where people will lose access to private healthcare, and probably no one will really ultimately benefit from the increase in funding to the public healthcare system that this proposes to provide. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We've gone a bit long, but thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting, and I hope you all have an excellent, wonderful, and magnificent weekend. It's almost the end of the year. I must say, it's always nice when one gets to December. So just one more month to make it through until December begins. And thank you very much, everyone. We'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.